Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series, where we bring you readings of short stories from the magazine's past issues. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes 6 double issues a year, full of the best mystery and crime short fiction. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. For this installment, we have Con Lehane reading his story, Stella by Starlight, from our October 2016 issue. Con Lehane is the author of 2 mystery series. The Brian McNulty series centers around the New York City bartender, and the 42nd Street Library mysteries feature the library's curator of crime fiction. He'll talk more about these 2 series after the story. But first, here's Stella by Starlight.
Sully had bartended at the old corral for as long as most of the winos could remember. Early on, he'd worked class joints, making his way up the ladder the old-fashioned way, from bar back to service bar to the front bar of one of the 5-star hotels in Midtown, and then back down the old-fashioned way, this time the old-fashioned in the rocks glass, amber liquor, muddled fruit, sugar, and bitters. And soon enough, only the amber liquor, through supper clubs, tourist traps, neighborhood bars. Finally, he landed at the old corral, not a skid row joint, though not many steps above one, as it was not many steps below Houston Street, where 3rd Avenue became the Bowery, in the days when the winos roamed that particular range with their bottles of Muscatel, and rooms in the flop houses above the gin joints were $3 a night. The night Stella and Sully met, it wasn't love at first sight. She blew into the bar on a snowy January night in front of one of the coldest winds the city had ever encountered. Sully had been watching through the smoke-frosted, grime-encrusted plate glass window as patterns of red and blue and orange from the Ballantine, Schaefer, and Pabst Blue Ribbon neon signs in the barroom windows danced on a floor of pure white, as the wind blew the snow sideways in sheets, and the winos, bent forward at the waist, noses toward the ground, made their way to the next bar or home to the flop. His first words to Stella were, "Close the fucking door." She looked up at him with dark, sorrowful eyes and a shy smile, her cheeks apple red, wisps of black hair flickering around her pug nose. She shook snow from the top of her head like an old sheepdog. Shadows of former beauty lurked behind her drink-ravaged face. They spent the night trapped by the blizzard, talking of the good times that were past and gone. When the sky cleared in the morning, they walked 3 blocks through thigh-high snow drifts to his room at the Sunshine Hotel. She stayed with him there until the morning, 3 months later, when the police arrived to take her away. "You're nuts," Sully told the uniformed cop who pinned him against the wall inside the hotel room door. "What's she charged with?" "Murder," said the plainclothes cop in a trench coat who was wrapping cuffs around her wrists as she struggled to get up from the bed. Her eyes met Sully's, hurt in her expression, bewilderment and pain, no anger. They booked her at the 5th Precinct Station House on Canal Street. The plainclothes cop, whose name was DiMaggio, told Sully she was charged with the murder of a man whose body was found in an alley alongside the Tuxedo Lounge on Rivington Street. "Bullshit," said Sully, his voice ringing with bravado. "The victim was her ex-husband." "So," said Sully, without as much bluster. "What's going on, Stella?" He finally got a chance to speak with her the next morning at 100 Center Street after her arraignment. She'd been assigned a legal aid attorney who arranged the visit. "The lawyer asked if I had collateral to put up for bail," she said. "I told him neither of us had a pot to piss in." She smiled. He said, "Sit tight." She turned her sad brown eyes on Sully. "When they asked me why I killed my ex-husband, I didn't know who they were talking about. I was married 5 times. He gave her a cigarette. When they told me who it was, I told them I'd shake the hand of whoever did it. Don't talk without a lawyer. I don't need the lawyer. What do I care? You couldn't argue with Stella, so he didn't. He asked her when she saw him last, her ex-husband, that is, whose name was Thomas Whitaker. Sully, you gotta understand, I don't want to talk about this. Let it go. Stella, you damn fool. Time's up, said the guard. She was with me the night the guy was killed. She didn't kill him. Why would anybody believe you? The legal aid lawyer dropped his gaze from Sully's challenging expression to look through a sheaf of papers. Sully, in fact, wasn't telling the whole truth. The night of the killing, Stella got a phone call on the payphone on the wall at the end of the bar and left the old corral shortly after midnight. That had never happened before. She was back long before closing. She never said where she went. Sully, as was his wont, didn't ask. I'm saying she was with me. It's my word against whose? The lawyer shrugged. How do you explain the gun? The gun? In her purse. We'll see when the ballistics tests come back. She never had a gun. In her purse when she was arrested. What'd she say? The lawyer rested his elbows on the formica top table and pressed his hands to his forehead. He seemed too young to be so weary. The same thing she said about everything else. Nothing. Sully'd never asked Stella about her past, only listened to what she wanted to tell him. So he knew little about her except she was kind and blamed no one for any misfortune that befell her. That she lived in an SRO in a room with a hot plate, a chipped and dented wooden table with two matching dented and chipped chairs, and shared a mattress on the floor, pints of vodka and six packs of beer with him, seemed what she expected and all she needed. He didn't know if he loved Stella or if she loved him. He hadn't thought about love since years before when his wife left and took their little girl back to Massachusetts. The emptiness of the room he went to after work each night when the darkness was waning and the sky beyond the Williamsburg Bridge was less empty when Stella was there. Whether she'd waited up for him or was dead drunk lying across the mattress. Jail would be hard on her. Despite the battering she'd taken from life, her heart wasn't hard enough for such a place. He traced her movements in the weeks preceding the murder, finding out more about her in that time than she told him in the time they'd been together. When they'd talked, sitting together on the mattress in the room in the SRO or on a bench in Tompkins Square Park, she told him about growing up on a farm in Wisconsin. She liked to remember adventures with her little brother. Enough stories about cows and rabbits and old workhorses to fill a book. Sully, who grew up in a housing project in Coney Island with a single mother, three brothers, and two sisters, likened Stella's bucolic life to the novels about 19th century England he'd read in the Coney Island Library on Mermaid Avenue where he went to escape the projects. It wasn't hard to get a handle on Stella's whereabouts during the days before the murder. The Bowery denizens knew her well and remembered seeing her here and there, in a greasy spoon, drinking at Tommy's, or on a bench in Tompkins Square Park when she wasn't with him, which was most of the time. Finding out about Thomas Whitaker didn't take much either. He made his nut threatening to run a greasy rag across the windshields of the Jersey commuters stuck on Canal Street in rush hour traffic, headed for the Holland Tunnel, unless they got to him with a tip before he got to the windshield. Most everyone in the Bowery knew Sully, too. He was a guy the Whitos trusted to cash their disability or welfare checks and run an honest tab. He found out what Stella had been up to from asking questions in a dozen whiskey joints and hash houses along the Bowery. He talked to waitresses at the Greasy Spoons, drunks sprawled across doorways or against the walls of buildings, working girls after they finished negotiations through the passenger side windows of dark cars with jersey plates. He tackled the Greasy Spoons and hash houses during the days, sent out emissaries from the Old Corral at night to roust out those who knew Stella or Thomas Whitaker with an offer of drinks on Sully for a bit of information. In less than a week, he'd pretty much gotten the story. When Thomas Whitaker married Stella, he was a doorman in a Kips Bay apartment building, and she was a waitress in the King Cole Lounge at the St. Regis. After their marriage, they lived in a walk-up on 3rd Avenue alongside the L. Stella was young and beautiful, spoiled and careless because of the beauty. Whitaker was her second or third husband. The husband after him was a rich man who frequented the King Cole Lounge. Took her to live in Larchwood. Whitaker had been a hard-working man who liked his drink. After Stella left, he hit the bottle pretty hard. They'd had a son together, and she took the boy with her to Larchmont. When things went bad with the rich guy, and Stella came back to the city, she and Whitaker shuffled the boy back and forth between them for a few years. Stella, being a too-many-parties-and-too-many-pals sort of gal, and Whitaker a lush, the parenting of the boy, whose name was Joseph, was deficient, if not negligent. By the time the kid was 13, he was the go-to guy for weed at the neighborhood intermediate school. The senior Whitaker, despite his own arm-length rap sheet, drunken, disorderly, simple assault, petty larceny, was outraged when the boy was hauled in for selling marijuana. The family court hearing shined an unforgiving light on the lackluster parenting of both Stella and Whitaker. Not surprisingly, they blamed one another. The judge, concurring with each one's appraisal of the other, took the kid away and put him in the foster care system. Stella went on a wagon, found an apartment in Woodside, Queens, gave up waitressing for an assembly job in a small electronic plant in Long Island City. She cleaned up her act, except in one small area. She began smoking pot in the evenings after work to take the edge off and help ward off the booze. When the next family court hearing came, Whitaker, still vindictive, sobered up enough to find a scandalized neighbor, not a difficult thing to do in Woodside, who testified that Stella was a pothead. Joseph went back to foster care, and Stella took to the bright lights again. The lights faded soon enough as she descended inexorably downtown until she reached the Bowery. Sully found out none of this from Stella. Always happy to see him, when he visited her at the women's jail on Rikers Island, she wouldn't talk about Thomas Whitaker. When he asked about Joseph, she waved him off with one hand, her tear-stained face buried in the other. She doesn't want to testify, that's her right, the bespectacled legal aid lawyer, still wet behind the ears, made an unsuccessful attempt at a challenging stare. Even if it would help her case? Usually it doesn't. What if she could tell you who the killer is? The lawyer sat back in his chair and removed his glasses. She'd have to have proof. Joseph Whitaker lived at Bay Ridge, a couple of blocks from the last stop on the R train. A bear-like, rough-around-the-edges guy, he had a one-bedroom apartment on the second floor of a four-story apartment building on 4th Avenue. Sully had never been to Bay Ridge. The streets were clean, if narrow, apartment buildings mostly on the avenues, neat and tidy row houses on the blocks between the avenues. He told the young man his mother was in jail. She's been in jail before. Whitaker sat on the edge of a wooden dining room chair, rubbed his hands together, avoided Sully's gaze, glancing over his shoulder every few seconds as if someone might sneak up on him. Not for murder. Joseph Whitaker continued to watch his hands rub against each other. They were thick, calloused, working man's hands. Who'd she murder? She didn't murder anyone. Someone murdered your father. He nodded. Do you know who killed him? This time Joseph shrugged. I knew he was dead. I got a call. No one told me she was in jail. A guy I know saw your mom that night. She met a guy. He's drinking shots in Al's bar. The guy I know never saw this guy before. Young, big. Stella gets there, scared, but not at a young guy. They go outside around the corner on Grant Street. She comes back, She drinks a couple of shots herself. The guy I know, he's a bartender there. Joseph Whitaker, his shoulders stooped, his head drooping, continued to watch, his hands rubbing against each other as if they had a life of their own. She says to the guy I know, "Forget you saw me." Which he does, except for me. We're bartenders, you know what I mean? We go back a ways. Whitaker's hands stopped rubbing. He held them between his knees, still staring at them, his shoulders stooped, his head drooping. "When did you see your father last?" Whitaker sat still, not even the blink of an eye. Sully had a friend in the police department. A lot of the guys he grew up with were cops. Barney Finnegan was the only one he thought of as a friend. He might be still sitting there. He didn't move, didn't talk for 10 minutes, didn't flinch when I got up and left. He might have turned to stone. Finnegan nodded. Sully lowered his voice. "The guy I know told me Thomas Whitaker had an argument, some shoving back and forth, with a big young guy in front of a bar at the corner of Bowery and Houston early the night he was killed." "What time was he killed?" Finnegan looked at a notebook. "Someone flagged down a cruiser at 10:03 p.m. and led the uniforms to the body." "There you go," said Sully. Finnegan said he'd look into it. The next day he showed up at the old corral with his partner, a black guy who seemed nice enough. The young Whitaker and his old man had a history, Finnegan said. The father took out an arrest warrant for the son a couple of years ago for robbery. It was dismissed. The older Whitaker was locked up once for assault, the charges brought by his son. "So?" Sully asked. "Gone," said Finnegan. "In the wind," said the black cop. "He had a bad childhood. Tears formed in the corners of Stella's eyes. My fault. I was drunk. His father smacked the kid around. I should have killed him then." "Stella, you didn't kill Thomas Whitaker, I found." "Stop." She held up a hand. "Not another word." Her eyes, fixed on his, turned coal black. The meekness, fear, and apology gone. "Let them prove I murdered Thomas." "Stella." "I mean it, Sully. You found out something, keep it to yourself." "What are they going to use for evidence?" Sully asked the legal aid lawyer. "Witnesses." "Witnesses to what?" "Bad blood." "Could you come out with it?" "An argument, an altercation, a threat." "When?" "His girlfriend, common law wife, says he was afraid of Stella. She threatened him." "That's no big deal." "There's the gun." The lawyer rubbed his chin, smooth as a baby's ass. An old-time Jewish lawyer would be better, a guy who knew the ropes. These 18B guys never got anyone off. "She had it. Don't mean she used it." "They might accept the plea." "Plea?" "Manslaughter. Parole after 5 years, if we're lucky." Sully told the lawyer what time Stella left the bar on the night of the murder and what time she returned. "Look it up. What time did they find the body?" "Shortly after 10. "There you go." Sully folded his arms across his chest. "Joseph came to see me." The pain in Stella's eyes accused him. "What'd you tell him, Sully?" Sully couldn't answer. For a long time they sat in silence. "You talked to the police, Sully?" It sounded like a question, but it wasn't. She looked at him like a mother might at her son who's done wrong but whom she'll always forgive. "You got things figured out like that guy in those detective books you read." Her smile widened. "You're a good man, Michael Sullivan, and I'll miss you." Sitting on the Q100 bus that was taking him back to Queensboro Plaza where he'd get the train back to Manhattan, as they crossed the Francis R. Buono Memorial Bridge, Sully watched a plane, lights like diamonds in the sky coming in lower and lower as it headed into land at LaGuardia. He'd never been on a plane. Stella told him she'd take the plea bargain the legal aid lawyer told her about. A 5-year minimum. Time didn't mean much to Sully. He didn't remember much about the last 5 years, nor the 5 years before that. The lawyer said jail time would count. He'd get the trial postponed a couple of times, and Sully could visit her at Rikers until she went up the river.
That was Conlahane reading his story, Stella by Starlight, from the October 2016 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. He read the story for us at the 2017 Malice Domestic Convention in Bethesda. Afterwards, I asked him to tell us a little more about his two mystery series and the inspirations behind them.
The first book in the Bartender series was Beware the Solitary Drinker, and that's a long time ago now that I wrote that. And that was sort of based as a bartender for a long time, for probably close to 15 years, while I thought I was writing the great American novel or something like that. And it turned out my experience bartending became the basis of the mystery. And I never set out to write mysteries either. That was a late development. And I thought maybe I'd just like write one. But I liked the mystery or crime fiction. I liked, because I'm sort of a social writer, you know, my concerns are what used to be, social novel or protest novel or whatever. So that's sort of my genre. And the crime fiction or mystery novel works really well for that. So I was able to sort of have a ready-made plot and structure because of the mystery, and then I could do this other stuff with. So I really liked it. And I did three books, and I thought the third one was the best. It was Death at the Old Hotel, and it got really good reviews. It was reviewed in the Times and the Wall Street Journal, and the pre-public reviews were pretty good. And they killed the series at St. Mark's or at Minotaur for who knows what reason. And then my editor, for those books, for two of those books, my first book was with Poison Pen Press, my editor is Marcia Markland, and she suggested that I write about New York, that that's my subject in a lot of ways, and she suggested I write a book at the library, set at the 42nd Street Library, which is, for most people, the New York Public Library, or the Fifth Avenue Library. New Yorkers call it the 42nd Street Library. So I did. And somewhere along the line, my bartender, McNulty, crept back into the story, and he became the sort of the watering hole for the library workers. So where they went after work, McNulty was the bartender. So I kept them working in the new series. So the first one was Murder at the 42nd Street Library, and it came out last November. The protagonist, the main protagonist, is Raymond Ambler, and he's the curator of the crime fiction collection. There is no real crime fiction collection, although there was a guy at the library who used to do talks on the crime fiction the library does have. But it was, again, sort of cheating for me, because I know crime fiction. I don't know how to be a librarian. So, that was so good and nice. I did some things different. My bartender series were all in the first person, McNulty's voice. The new books are in the third person with different points of view. It's not just not just Raymond Ambler, but there's another woman that he works with and is friends with. There's a cop who's a friend of his, and so they get their own point of view or their own voice in the book. In fact, the first book, there's probably 8 or 9 different voices, points of view. And then the new one.
And what's the title? The new one there.
It's Murder in the Manuscript Room. All my bartender titles were mine. I turn in a book with a title, and the publisher was fine with them. Mm-hmm. And the last two, my editor insisted on the titles. And I think she knows something that I don't know about titles, but they wouldn't have been my choices. But so.
Did you grow up in New York?
No, I grew up in Connecticut. And my father was a gardener on a private estate. But we're in Stamford, Greenwich, New Canaan. So we're always in the suburbs of New York. So if you watch TV, it was a New York station. Everybody read the Daily News. My bailiwick read the Daily News. Other people read the Times, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I always, and we had, my family had relatives in New York. Both my parents came from Ireland, and my mother came from a fairly large family who, she had six sisters, maybe, who came to New York, and there was one aunt who lived in Brooklyn, who was you had to have someone to sponsor you when you came from Ireland, so she was like the sponsor for all these people, and so a lot of them were in New York, and I spent a lot of time there when I was a kid. In fact, when I was in high school, my aunt had a rooming house in Brooklyn in Flatbush, and there was a bar across the street, and it was a residential street. It was a brownstone, her house. I mean, she owned her house, it was real, and she rented rooms to pretty much mostly Irish single men. But I remember I was doing something in New York, and I spent a week, I think, at her. And I would look out at the bar, and I thought that someday I'd want to write a book called Tales from a Brooklyn Bar. And that was, so my connection to bars goes back that far. But also the library. You know, I realized when I was doing the book that my first book, Beware the Solitary Drinker, it opens at a bar, but the next scene is on the steps of Low Library at Columbia, and he's looking across at Butler Library. And also there's a scene later where he goes to McNulty, the bartender, goes to the 42nd Street Library to look up some stuff and finds out the background on some of the suspects using their library resources. So I sort of knew somehow that I'd end up with a library also in those early days.
That was Con Lehane talking about his writing at the Malice Domestic Convention in Bethesda at the Hyatt Regency Hotel, which graciously provided the space for us to record this podcast. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a bi-monthly digest published by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McClafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for joining us.